Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode 105. I'm here, as always, with my friend Zhao. How you doing?
All good, Jay. As always, a pleasure. Yeah, back from Christmas and New Year and all of that. Happy New Year to everybody. Quite a few roundup of stories that we have today to cover, but you had something else that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, we'll be, just to give a little teaser, we'll be covering bucket-related shenanigans, which those of you that are using S3 buckets or an equivalent technology in your cloud provider, you know what I'm talking about. And you probably know where this is going. We're going to talk about leaky buckets. It's going to be a bucket of fun. But and some other shenanigans, too. I like that word, shenanigans. We use it a lot, especially in security. Speaking of shenanigans, I just wanted to just point out a video I released this week yesterday that's an inside look at a real data center. I figured it'd be a good treat for people within our audience for this podcast, because my whole problem has been that when you're learning IT, you spend a lot of time reading about it, maybe watching videos, reading blogs, maybe practicing, but most people don't seem to see the inside of a data center until the first day of their job out of college. Like they go to school hearing about what a data center is like, they read about what it's like, but they don't generally step into one until they start. And it's kind of one of those things where I like to show people what their career is going to be like, not just when you're learning and going through tutorials. I mean, yeah, that's important. I need to teach you guys the way that businesses use the technology. But I've always wanted to, show an inside look at a data center, which has never happened before because it's extremely hard. Like, I've had several companies where I've come close to an agreement, but some security compliance thing shoots it down. It's nothing personal to me, obviously. It's just security rules. Our security rules are rightfully so. We got to keep our data center secure. We can't just let some random YouTuber in a data center, but obviously, I jest because I'm not that random. Anyway, so I figured it'd be a fun video, and I wanted to do it in a more documentary style. It's a longer video, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you see a video titled Inside Look at a Real Data Center on the YouTube channel, definitely check that one out. I was in Chicago filming that one, which is part of the reason I'm so discombobulated, is like going to Chicago, and that was a lot of fun, but a lot of hard work, and then the holidays right after that, and then getting caught up. But it's all good because it was a lot of fun. So definitely check out that video. I had a great time in Chicago. Shout out to Big Scoots for inviting me out there and letting me browse their, or actually walk around their data center, which is a heck of a lot of fun. So check out that video. So with that out of the way, I believe our first story of the day is actually not entirely new, but it's like a gift that keeps on giving, regression.
Yeah, it's one of those vulnerabilities that we probably said at the time. By the way, let's take this from the beginning. This was a vulnerability that was disclosed in July, July 1st, To give you a brief history about it, it's essentially a flaw in SSHD, in that there are some functions that are triggered by a particular signal inside of SSHD. So when somebody tries to connect to an SSH server, those signals will be triggered, and then the functions that are going to be called happen to be run at the same time. And those handlers were not designed to be run at the same time, so they will introduce some unexpected behavior there. And this is triggerable remotely and can lead to remote code execution. And that sounded awfully scary at the time, but there is one tiny caveat here, is that it's a probabilistic attack. You're not sure that you're going to get the flaw on your first attempt. So it can take a long time for you to actually trigger this if you're an attacker and trying to exploit it. So the reason that we're coming back to it again is that in last week, I believe it was already in January, there was a proof of concept that was published on GitHub and is freely available for anybody that's interested in looking at it. And it actually makes the exploit easier to attack. And the thing is, you're going to enter into this infinite monkeys with typewriter scenario where you'll have more people trying the attack, and eventually, even if it's a probabilistic attack, somebody's going to be lucky enough to trigger it and get remote code execution faster than others. So the big story here is that if you still haven't updated SSHD, if you were not too scared when this came out in July of last year, it's probably a good time to look at the version that you have running on your systems. And if there's an update for SSHD, please take it and be safe from this type of vulnerabilities, because remote code execution is always tricky to defend against.
Yeah, and also, it's always been the case for me that SSH is always the first thing I update every single time. Like, there could be a bunch of updates, and even if I'm going to update all of the or install all of those later that afternoon, as soon as I see an SSH update, it's immediate like that. Because we have to understand that this is how we manage our servers, and it's how other people can manage our servers too, even those that shouldn't be. It's like a door. You know, you can leave the door wide open. But the interesting thing is, according to the article we have linked, BSD fixed this back in 2001, and they haven't had an issue since. Meanwhile, some platform differences and other things kind of get into it and create an avenue for attack on Linux. But according to the article, OpenBSD had that fixed in 2001.
Yeah, that's the thing. We actually covered this in July, but that's the interesting, the other interesting part of this specific vulnerability. This was a flaw that was identified in 2005. It was fixed in 2006. And then apparently everybody forgot about it, so it was reintroduced with a new commit to the codebase in 2018. And that's how it got back into SSHD after being fixed for like 12 years. And that's why we're facing it again. It's actually more dangerous now than it was at the time, because running the functions in parallel became more problematic when you have multiple CPUs and multiple cores available to run those functions. So it's more likely that you'll trigger the scenario where they happen to be at the exact precise moment that the vulnerability needs to be able to be exploited than it was with low core counts in 2005, 2006. So that's why this is dangerous again. There's also another caveat here that it's more impactful to 32-bit systems because it's faster to trigger it. You'll take days rather than weeks or months if it's a 64-bit system. But it's still dangerous. It's still a risk, and the attacker might get very lucky and get it on the first try. So again, it's better to be protected than to take your chance, and it's just another update.
It is. It just underscores how important SSH is and how much it could be a huge problem. And obviously, I know I've said this a lot, and probably in the original episode when we covered this, I probably mentioned it a few times, but you need to firewall SSH. Under no circumstances should SSH be accessible from the internet without some other means of giving you the ability to access it. Because as soon as you have it connected to the public internet, And even then, there could still be attack vectors if there's issues in your firewall. But at the same time, it's surprising how many people have open SSH open to the world. Actually, it's not surprising because most cloud providers default to that. I mean, if you think about it, right? You spin up a VPS instance or a cloud instance, and obviously you need to be able to access SSH to do your first initial, you know, configuration of that machine. But if you don't update it, and better yet, firewall it off, I mean, you're just asking for trouble. And this is just one of the ways that someone that's very determined could try to get in.
I mean, a quick show then scan shows about 14 million SSH servers really available on the internet. So yeah, there are lots of systems out there with SSHD exposed. The POC, the code that was just released on GitHub, it actually makes it easier because it identifies the function, the versions of SSHD that are vulnerable and doesn't waste time with the ones that are not. It also looks for potential mitigations that have been applied. This is dependent on a specific setting inside SSHD called login grace period, which if it's not at the default of 120 seconds, then it's even harder to exploit. So it will make sure to check those things so that it doesn't waste time trying to hack systems that are not hackable. And yeah, again, definitely something to be worried.
And the last thing I'll mention on my end, I mean, this is pretty much what you just said, but just underscore it. Yeah, things might be hard for a threat actor to use right now. There could be a vulnerability like this one on a 64-bit system. It only gets easier, though. I mean, if you think about a situation where there's a security vulnerability, but the threat actor has to jump through 10 hoops and do a backflip and land the right way, I mean, chances are they'll probably just use something else to get into your system. But eventually, with CPUs getting better and better and better, what used to take months might take minutes. And if you don't have it patched, as soon as you know your hardware gets better, then guess what? So too do the attacks. So this is a good indicator. We can't let anything go. Even if you have confidence that, oh, what are the chances that someone's going to go through that much trouble to get into my system? Well, they could if it's a targeted attack. But even if they don't, later on, it could become a problem when things get a lot easier. And that's why we also tell people, you know, if you get crypto or ransomware on your machine, keep those files, tuck them somewhere safe, you know, maybe, and we've seen this before where the FBI has something and they could finally get it. So it just, things change and things get easier for both us and the threat actors, but let's not make it too easy and update SSH, please.
Yeah. Okay, so the next story that we have is probably one of the feel-good stories for the Linux community because it affects Windows, and we all like to say bad things about Windows, but anyhow.
Well, I mean, it's literally called Worst Fit right in the title there. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Anyway, no offense to those people, I'm only joking.
Half joking, for sure.
Kind of.
So this was disclosed yesterday or 2 days ago at most. Like you said, it's called Worst Fit. Again, naming vulnerabilities is a bad idea, but anyhow. So this is a vulnerability that affects Windows systems. And please stick around because we will bring the story back to Linux in no time. This is a vulnerability that affects Windows systems, and it affects it in a very convoluted and interesting way. Earlier Windows versions, and I'm talking Windows 3.0, 3.11, they started with support for ANSI CodePage, probably earlier versions too. And much later than that, they got support for UTF. Linux does a pretty good job at supporting UTF right now. It wasn't always like that, but right now it's pretty solid the way that Linux does this. So what happens with Windows, and this is something that's an architectural choice for Windows and has been that way for decades, and it's one of the things that you can regularly rely on, is that Windows doesn't really deprecate functions. It's very likely that you can still run software that was designed for Windows 3.11 on your Windows 11 machine right now. And that's
Windows 10 has the Windows 3.1 program manager accessible right in the folder, believe it or not.
And we're talking about code that was written 30 years ago and still runs on what you have right now. And Microsoft has been, and again, this is a particular personal choice, but I believe Microsoft has been very consistent and very good in maintaining support for older software. They are not very interested in introducing breaking changes to their existing ecosystem of software, and that's a bold choice to make. It's very easy to look at other operating systems, and I'm not even mentioning Linux right here. If you look at macOS, it's very easy for them to introduce breaking changes and make software that run on older versions no longer be supported. So what that means is that to make sure that they don't break older code, whenever they need to introduce support for something new, like, say, introducing support for UTF code, they have to create new functions to support that. So you have a function that does text conversion for ANSI, and you have another function that does text conversion for UTF. Because when you're writing code, most often you're not worried about which specific encoding you're using. What happens is that Windows behind the scenes will call those functions and convert text that is written in UTF to ANSI if that's what's expected on the function that you're calling from your code. And since UTF has thousands of characters and ANSI has a couple hundred, then there's for sure a mapping that has to happen between one to the other, and there will be collisions when doing that mapping. Different symbols on UTF will map to the same character on ANSI. For example, if you look at the minus sign, there are about 10, 20 different UTF characters that represent the same minus sign, the dash, the whatever, and get translated to one single character on ANSI.
Yep, so, like the M dash,
yeah. Yeah, a lot of them, the M dash and lots of others. And then there are some mappings that are quite weird and you don't really understand why the mapping happens that way. So the algorithm that Microsoft came up is called Best Fit. And this happens behind the scenes. This was developed at Microsoft. It's an internal algorithm that they developed. And its single purpose is exactly mapping characters from the UTF character set into ANSI. And what happens is that since the applications are not necessarily written to explicitly work with one or the other, it's possible to pass UTF characters as, say, parameters to a command line application in Windows. And they might look in a weird way to you, but they get interpreted in a different way by the application due to the best fit algorithm that converts it to something else behind the scenes. For example, the square root sign gets converted to a V. For example, the infinity symbol gets converted to an 8 for whatever reason. There are lots of weird mappings happening here. But the thing is, since this happens behind the scenes and the applications don't really concern themselves too much with this type of translation that's happening, this can lead to scenarios where garbled text or what appears to be garbled characters written in UTF as parameters get interpreted as something different. And there's mapping that lets you, for example, specify weird characters that then get translated into past reversal characters, like stuff, Japanese characters that get translated into dot dot, for example. And that doesn't get picked up by the checks that the application has in place because it's not ANSI directly. So if it's looking for the ANSI match, it doesn't match. But then when it's interpreting it, it will actually translate to move into a different directory. And that's how worst fit came to be. Somebody actually went to the trouble of going through all of the characters, finding the right matches, and finding ways to abuse this in existing applications. There are lots of applications on Windows that are vulnerable to this. There are lots of functionality inside of Windows that's vulnerable to this. And some standouts are, for example, PHP, Python, Perl. When they are used on Windows, they are all vulnerable to this. So all the software that is then written on Python, PHP, or Perl and run on Windows environments is also vulnerable to this. If you have a website running on Windows Server, if it's running PHP code, and you have a file upload scenario or sync on your application, then you're vulnerable to this. And that is massive.
Yeah, a lot of developers run a local web server for testing and things, and yeah, especially be vulnerable to something like this. It seems to me like almost, if not every time you're converting something from one thing to another, there's always a risk of someone converting it into something that you didn't want it converted into, or some kind of an instruction. I mean, we see this with SQL injection attacks, which is like the classic that, you know, we've talked about forever. And when it comes to Unicode characters, I mean, on Linux, I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, because I've always had Unicode support for as long as I can remember installed by default on everything, but it just shows an invalid character that you can't really make out anytime, you know, you don't have support for that. It'd be like a rectangle with like some dots in it or something. But then Windows apparently is going to convert it into a completely similar character like the 8 or the V that you mentioned. That's kind of bad.
I promised I would turn this story back around to Linux, and I will. We talked about a different vulnerability. It was probably over a year now, but there was this vulnerability that affected Linux as well. Because UTF is weird like that. UTF is not just a character set. It also includes control characters. And by this, I mean that one of the things that you can write as a character that's not actually printed to screen is a text direction change character, meaning that you're all happy there writing your text left to right, writing whatever you're trying to write, then you try to write that direction change character, and now you're writing on the opposite direction. So you're overwriting what you had written before. And now you write your text in the wrong direction, and now you switch direction again with a different character, and you continue to write what was there before. On screen, you won't see that. So that happens as the text is being written. That's immediate. You don't catch that. You don't see what was underneath the text that was just written. So it's possible, for example, to write RM, as in remove, give it a pass, then write over that pass and show something else innocuous, and you won't even be have any way of looking at the screen and seeing that you're actually deleting two passes and not just one.
Right.
And this was a vulnerability, I believe, last year or 2 years ago. It was Ghost something. I can't make up the name again. And again, silly names and vulnerabilities are not really useful. But it exploited the same thing. UTF is not just a character set. It's a very complicated puzzle that developers, for some reason, try to come up and mix all the character sets together and make it easier to use all of the different character sets without conversions. But it includes stuff like control characters, and you get into messes like this. That particular Linux vulnerability is also UTF related, and if you're a developer or if you work with GitHub in any fashion, it's one of the reasons why you now see a warning on GitHub whenever you try to submit a file with code that includes UTF non-printable characters, and you'll get this pop-up or this warning at the top that says, warning, this file has some weird characters there that are not printable, so you're not actually seeing what those characters are, and it's alerting you that you shouldn't trust that file because you're not entirely sure of what's there. And that's a real risk. The console utilities that you use might respect the text direction changes. They might not alert you that it happened, and you have no way of knowing that that was there. So if you were feeling pretty good about yourself by not running Windows and not being vulnerable to worst fit, UTF is a mess, and it also impacts Linux in many different ways.
Yeah, it's important we keep in mind vulnerability chaining, because just like we Linux people chain commands together to get a particular result, threat actors do the exact same thing with vulnerabilities. You know, as soon as you have a vulnerability where you can write text a certain direction, then you have a Unicode vulnerability that gives you, I mean, just imagine the two together. It's kind of incredible, but that's very common. So I'm glad that the story came full circle, because it's yet another example of that kind of thing.
Okay, and you mentioned leaky buckets before. Let's get into that part of the show for today. So we're going to be talking about some AWS security issues. First up, it's Volkswagen, the car maker who was in trouble a few years back for faking emission data, apparently left private data of about 800,000 cars sitting right there for 6 months on a poorly protected Amazon leaky bucket. And obviously, when you leave data out in the open like that, it's going to be found, it's going to be leaked. And that's precisely what happened. So that data included precise location tracking of those 800,000 vehicles. So it shows where those vehicles were and where they are right now at the time that the data was taken. So there's a whole history of where that vehicle was and where it moved through and where it drove and where it sit parked. And there's also the information about the owners of the car. It's possible to link both informations there. And Volkswagen is not just a Volkswagen brand. They actually own Audi and Skoda and Seat and a whole host of other brands. So this is pretty massive. And if you're wondering, yeah, but that's a German brand, so it only affects German vehicles. No, that vehicle location data is worldwide. There's information for cars parked all over the world. And that thing is massive.
Yep. And, you know, another thing, too, is that a lot of cloud providers use, a version of or compatible to S3 buckets. They have their own service. But as we're going to talk a little bit more, there's key related shenanigans that come into play as well. But to kind of rewind a little bit, for those of you that are new with object storage, which is what this is, it's basically a one-to-one relationship when it comes to a file. You have a file name in the file. That's it. You don't have permissions. I mean, there might be some metadata in the bucket, but it's very stripped down. You only have a very little bit of information, because the buckets are more for just data storage specifically. It's not going to be as full featured as a NAS server or anything like that. It's just for simple file storage, which is what it's called on Amazon. Now, the thing is that And what I see a lot in enterprise is that a lot of junior administrators or people that are even more beginner than that, when they first start looking at this, they don't realize that they need to look at those permissions right away, because it's way too easy to leave a bucket on the default settings, and everyone in the world can do that. And you can have a company where all the S3 buckets are secure and private, and then a junior employer, a beginner, comes in and is working on a server. Oh, I'm just going to create this temporary bucket for a few days just to store this data that I'm manipulating or doing something with. And then they don't secure it. They leave it out there. And then I'm not saying necessarily that's what happened here, but the case is a lot of people don't secure S3 buckets. It's just like SSH, where you found, what was it, 14 million or something like that on Shodan? I'm sure the number is pretty high on S3 buckets as well. I mean, you would expect a company like Volkswagen to know better, but the fact of the matter is all enterprise companies that use S3 storage should be auditing this regularly, because you could finish an audit today and then tomorrow someone can open up a public bucket with data that you don't want leaking out. And then we can get into governance, which we talked about in a previous episode, to kind of put more restrictions on what your people are able to do. But in this case, 800,000 vehicles or data for 800,000 vehicles just being out there in the public. I mean, that's insane. That's just crazy.
There's also, again, there's always some wrinkles to the story, as there always is. But in this case, it wasn't that they actually forgot to protect the bucket. It's that they left the keys out in the open. So the way that this information was found was because some members of the CCC, and the CCC is the Chaos Computer Club. It's a hacker club that started in Berlin in 1981. It's the largest European hacker group. And some of its members, being in Berlin, they looked at Volkswagen stuff. And the Volkswagen group has an IT company that handles IT for all of their subsidiaries. And they were looking for assets from that IT company, and they found a memory dump for one of the applications. And that memory dump was on an unprotected leaky bucket. And they got access to the dump, they examined the memory dump, and they found the AWS keys there. And that's how they got access to the tracking data. The funny thing there is that while the leaky bucket was not immediately exposed directly, somebody left the way to find the keys and left it accessible. This is the type of things that should have been caught in, say, a red-blue team exercise when you have somebody trying to hack and look at your assets. And that's the kind of stuff that this type of things will find. They will find when you leave things out in the open that you shouldn't. Again, it's not that they actually left it unprotected immediately. It wasn't just coming out and looking at the data, but you're leaving the keys right next to it. So it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, it's essentially the same thing, but and I didn't mean to imply that they did that, but at the same time, it's when you, and you know this just as well as I do, when you work in the industry, there's just certain things you see a lot. Like you walk into a random company like with a certain level of experience and they ask you to audit our systems, there's going to be some things that you pretty much expect to find. And an open S3 bucket is on my list of things that I'm going to look for first. Just like SSH being open to the world is one of the things I'm going to look at first. There's a number of these things that I look at first when I audit a company, and it just never fails. And the other thing, of course, is a massive storage bill when they have all these backups running and they never thought to have it automatically delete something that's, you know, 5 years old or something like that. And this is one of them. You know, I can't count how many times it's just crazy to me how many companies just don't secure their buckets.
I can give you a few more examples. Multi-factor authentication not being implemented, systems not being patched, the usual. Again, at TechScare, we see lots of companies with unpatched systems just because they're not essential or not critical or something like that. So they're not very essential when it comes to patching and maintenance operations. So yeah, they haven't been patched in years.
Right.
Anyhow, the following story also touches on AWS. And again, it will circle back to the Volkswagen story in a somewhat tangential way. And I actually caught this story from a tweet from your friend Tom that he posted a couple of days ago as well. It's about the new pass through to ransomware deployment, and it directly affects AWS stuff. So, like we mentioned, there are buckets, and then inside the buckets there are objects, and there are permissions that you can set for this, and permissions that you set on objects can override the permissions on the bucket. But again, you should actually create the permissions first and default everything to those permissions so that there's never a moment where funny stuff can happen with the data that you're uploading into the bucket. Amazon has another facility called the Key Management Service. That key management service is where you create the keys that you can use to encrypt your data so that nobody can look at it, and it stores the keys securely. And those keys can also have permissions. You can create keys that can only encrypt and others that can only be used for decryption and give access to only ones or the others to different accounts. One thing that I didn't know and researching this story actually taught me was that keys from a different account can encrypt data on your own buckets. I was not aware of that.
I wasn't either, actually, until I read the article, and I'm still not sure I fully understand, because I was certified in AWS. I don't use it, so I let it expire. But anyway, with as much time and energy as I spent in AWS, I'm surprised I didn't even know that.
So here's how the attack pass goes. An attacker creates a KMS key on their own personal AWS account, or a compromised account, and it gives it world access to use that key for encryption, meaning that it could be used to encrypt by any other AWS account to encrypt data elsewhere. Okay. The attacker finds a target S3 bucket and gains write level access to it, a leaky bucket, for example, where the permissions are not properly deployed, and then checks for two things. Checks if there's versioning in place, because if there's versioning when you create a new object, then you can always restore and go back to the previous version, and you don't really have any option of going around that. So it doesn't really make much sense to attack that and ransomware that data if somebody can just roll back to the previous version. So it looks for that, and it looks for multi-factor authentication. If multi-factor authentication is not there and versioning is, then you can just simply go in and remove versioning. If there is multi-factor authentication, then you cannot do it and the attack won't succeed against this target. Another reason why you should always have multi-factor authentication. So the thing here is that you have the key that was created on a different account and it has permissions to be fully usable by any other account to encrypt any other data. And you can use it to encrypt the data on that bucket that you found. The owner of the bucket with the data that you just encrypted has no way of knowing the key that was used and has no access to that key. So effectively, you just ransomware that data because you're the only one who has access to the key. If you now automate deleting the key, say, in 7 days, and you drop a message on the bucket, a text file that you don't encrypt and just says, okay, you need to send me 10 bitcoins or the key is gone forever, you have essentially done a ransomware attack against that data. That's right. Mind-blowing that the key can be used in that way, and the owner has no recourse and no access to the key, or even knowing from where that key came from. And it's still data.
If I'm understanding it correctly, it kind of does make sense in a way, because presumably the bucket would have to have write access enabled. So if it's a read-only bucket, unless there's a security vulnerability that bypasses that, then they're not going to do anything. So essentially, encrypting an S3 bucket that's writable isn't dissimilar than encrypting the contents of a flash drive that are also public. Because basically, if you think of the S3 bucket as an open hard drive, even though hard drive is the last thing I should equate it to because it's different, but I'll just simplify it down to that, and the world has write access to it, then someone who has their own AWS account creates a key in their key management service. Since that bucket's writable to the world, there's no stopping anyone, right? They're just finding something that's open.
Yeah.
Because it's open is why they're able to do this.
The reason why this is something new is that you're not deploying any software to do the encryption. You're just relying on AWS's functionality directly. You don't have to deploy malware to AWS. You don't have to upload any type of virus there or any type of Trojan there to get the code to encrypt. You're just relying on AWS functionality to encrypt the data. And the way that AWS is architected allows you to do this. Again, and this completely boggles the mind, how a key on one account can be used to encrypt data on a different one. And yeah, looking at the description of the attack, it does make sense. The data is there, the data is open, I'm using the key to encrypt data, it doesn't really care about where that data resides. But making the attack fully reliant and just work off the land with what AWS gives you actually gives you less of a way of tracking who created this and who is behind the attack. Because there's less logging, there's less stuff being uploaded, there are less access to the data and to the infrastructure. And the end result is exactly the same. You're extorting money for data, for access to the data that it's already owned by that person and that target. The way that this ties back to the Volkswagen story is that if an attacker had thought about it and had decided to ransom Volkswagen, since they had the key to access the bucket, they could have done this. So this is the type of things that could have happened.
I'm surprised they didn't.
I'm actually surprised as well that they didn't. But again, this is supposedly new attack vector. At least as far as I'm concerned, I had never heard of it before. And it's really interesting. Again, not having to deploy any software to be able to encrypt data and doing so with just the tools that you have at hand and make the attack be effective as it is, it's really, really interesting.
And I want to give a little disclaimer because the ease of, like I feel like just about any IT person of just about any skill level that has used the command line for more than a week could utilize this. So I want to give the disclaimer, obviously, but I have to say this, nobody in my audience should be looking for S3 buckets to encrypt and cause trouble. Okay, obviously that goes without saying, but I just wanted to say that because the means of exploiting something like this, presumably, the AWS CLI command, okay, your key, and I'm super summarizing this command line syntax, your key, and then the address of the bucket, okay? That's the ease of exploitation. Again, assuming I'm understanding this correctly, and I think that I do, that's how easy this is. So obviously we need to be good people and not do this, but one thing about this that it kind of does give you, and we had a hackers or attackers mindset episode in the past that was really good, but this is kind of like that, because if you have a threat actor that, you know, steals data from a company, and then at the same time they see in the news there's a vulnerability or something going on with S3, then the hacker's mindset, or I should say threat actor, I hate using hacker in that context, but the threat actor's mindset is to see how these two unrelated things can work together, because the S3 bucket story in Volkswagen, yes, they both have something to do with buckets, but they're different stories. But to an attacker, they're not different. Yes, they're different, but to an attacker, it's what two or three or four or 10 things can I link together to create a situation? And in this case, the means of intrusion is easy. So I'm hoping everyone, please, if you use S3, just take this as a sign. Just have a look at your permissions. And also, if you have a bucket that is supposed to be public, and I'll give you an example of a good reason for a public bucket. Let's say you're a software developer and you're releasing a new version of your app. It's not uncommon to have a public bucket that has the installer to your application. Obviously, there should be some protections there too, but it's common, right? But if it's not a situation like that, make sure it's locked down. And if it is a bucket that only includes data that's not important, not personally identifiable, would not matter if it leaks out, still check it anyway, okay? Because that could still be a problem. And just ask yourself, is this okay? You know, if someone got into this bucket and did something, what would life be like? And just give it a quick audit, because as many companies as I see that have problems with this, I'm willing to bet a good number of people in the audience will probably find something and tell your manager once you find it. You know, obviously don't make changes and go rogue without approval and a change request, but make sure you let your manager know, hey, look, this could have been a problem and I found it. And that's an opportunity for some of you guys to, you know, have a look and see what you could find. It's just sad that there's so many vulnerable buckets out there, but it is what it is. People will people.
The public proof of concept code is less than 20 lines of Python. So yeah, there's that.
I know, and here I'm sitting thinking and conspiring without saying too much. I could do it in one, but of course I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Never mind.
Anyway.
And if you believe that your alerting is enough to send you some emails and some alerts and start ringing the bells when something like this happens, a 100 gigabytes bucket was encrypted in a minute and 47 seconds. That's 900 megabytes per second. Your alerting will not come fast enough to stop this. So when you receive the email that too much data has changed or too much data has been updated or uploaded to your bucket, it's already too late. You really need to check the permissions on the buckets if you have them. You need to make sure that you don't leak the keys somehow. If you need to change secrets, now is probably a good idea and probably a good moment to do that, because again, as soon as this story breaks out, and it has been out for a couple of days, people are looking for buckets and they're just looking for the right opportunity to encrypt data. It's very easy. Code is out there. Look at the links that we post for this story. There's more data there that really need to pay attention to. And it's a dangerous scenario again.
Yeah, it really is. I feel like we need to have an episode of like 20 things everybody should check right now. But, you know, the thing is, you know, it is what it is. We're going to tell you guys what you should be doing to fix these things. Whether or not people are listening to the podcast like they're supposed to, that's not something I could promise. But hopefully more people will listen and find out what they're doing wrong. And then we'll have fewer leaky buckets as a result. But yeah,
I'm sure we won't. Anyhow, those were our stories for today. Thank you very much to everybody who joined. As always, a pleasure, and until the next one.
Thank you, guys.